Capital Region. Welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting on WOOCLP 90, 105.3 FM Troy and WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady. From the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, I'm Alexis Goldsmith. Tonight, we'll start off today's show by hearing from Assemblymember Phil Steck about his reaction to Governor Cuomo's State of the State, reported on by HMM's Mark Dunley. And then Paul Smart will report on Governor Cuomo and District Superintendent Kawita Adams as they address the insurrection on the Capitol and COVID-19 safety in Albany. Later on, HMM's Elizabeth Press speaks with Jamaica Miles of All of Us about police brutality and white supremacy. After that, we have another episode of Birth Justice, this time from HMM's Catherine Rafferty, who's joined by Rose Mitchell Tanerowitz. And to close out the show, HMM's roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry talks with Tom Ellis about the history of the Martin Luther King Jr. celebration in the Capital Region. But first, we have our headlines. The University at Albany will open for mass COVID-19 vaccinations starting on Friday, state officials confirmed Monday. Vaccinations will be given on campus in the university's Northwest Gold parking lot by appointment only. Individuals can make an appointment by calling the state's new vaccination hotline at 1-833-697-4829. Again, to make an appointment and to find out if you're eligible for the vaccine, call 1-833-697-4829. The state recently expanded the vaccine distribution to include essential workers and those over 75. The governor is pushing back against a federal CDC guideline to start vaccinating those over 65, but New York will allow such individuals to register for an appointment. The Times Union reports that Saratoga County had 17 new deaths from COVID-19 since Friday, the most fatalities the county has recorded in a three-day period since the pandemic began. The Daily Gazette reports that North Country Congressmember Elise Stefanik has been removed from a Harvard advisory committee over, quote, public assertions about voter fraud in November's presidential election that have no basis in evidence, end quote. Stefanik was approached to resign from the board, but declined that and chose to be removed. Stefanik was quoted as considering the removal from the board as a badge of honor and rite of passage for a conservative public official in a collegiate setting. During Monday's State of the State address, Governor Cuomo emphasized the need to reimagine law enforcement. The Gazette noted that rather than imposing a one-size-fits-all solution, Cuomo is requiring every entity that operates a single police agency to come up with a plan to fit that community's needs, subject to the approval of the Cuomo administration. Cuomo has cited Schenectady as a model effort. During his speech, Governor Cuomo laid out an expansive plan to rebuild New York involving green energy, new manufacturing, social justice, affordable broadband for all, subsidized health care, and assistance for immigrants. The plan would cost billions of dollars, with the state already facing a $15 billion shortfall. The governor wants the federal government to pay for most of his plan. He continued to push back against raising taxes on the wealthy. The two revenue measures he proposed, the legalization of cannabis and expanded sports gambling, would raise less than $1 billion. The city of Troy is extending the deadline for payment of the first installment of 2021 property tax payments for 21 days until February 21st. How many times can we say 21 in one headline? House members will reconvene at the Capitol Tuesday to pass a resolution urging the vice president to use the 25th Amendment to remove President Trump from office following last week's coup attempt, which killed five individuals. If that fails as expected, the House plans later this week to vote to impeach Trump for a second time. The Senate, however, is not expected to take up the impeachment until after President Biden is sworn in. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. This is local news produced by the community, for the community, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. This program is kept on the air by many volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. Thank you. To hear all of the stories on today's program, Visit mediasanctuary.org to send comments or suggestions. Email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390. And you can also find us on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter at Media Sanctuary. Up first on tonight's show, HMM's Mark Dunley spoke with Assemblymember Phil Steck about Governor Cuomo's State of the State address. Their conversation touches upon issues such as tax the rich, stock transfer tax, the governor's handling of COVID, and cannabis legalization.
We're talking with Assemblymember Phil Steck, who represents part of Albany County. This week, the legislature is stored in a new two-year session, and the governor delivered at least part of his State of the State address, outlining his goals and his assessment of the priorities and problems facing the state. So, Assemblymember, what was some of your reactions to the governor's State of the State address?
Well, it was filled with platitudes, but it lacked anything of a true meaningful nature. The essence of the speech was to blame everything on the federal government, and we've got a $15 billion deficit. The proposals he's come out with so far, marijuana legalization, sports betting, and borrowing lots of money, are not good solutions. There are much better solutions from an economic perspective. A lot of my constituents think that marijuana legalization and legalizing sports betting, which I support both things, would raise a lot of money. That's not the reason to do it. It doesn't raise a lot of money. And if we want to get serious about this, we got to put an end to this neoliberal economics and do something like the stock transfer tax.
So the governor apparently was pretty dismissive of the concept of taxing the rich, including the stock transfer tax. And I know you have a bill in to stop rebating it, but he was arguing, I think, yes, in his State of the State address that, that's less than $1 billion. That's not going to solve our, $15 billion deficit. How did you respond to his lowballing of the estimate how much we could raise from taxes?
He'd greatly appreciate it if the governor would tell the public the truth. The reality is that tax has a record and would raise on average of $11 billion a year, according to the state's own numbers. So the governor is just not being honest with us on that. And, another thing that he loves to talk about is, everybody's going to leave New York, this and that. Let me make a point here on that. We'll talk about New York City first and then upstate. So in New York City, there's no record of anybody leaving New York City. New York City has the highest sales tax and the highest income tax anywhere in the state of New York. So if the governor were right, people would be leaving New York City in droves. They haven't been. The only reason they leave New York City is because with COVID, there's a perception of a public health problem. On upstate New York, both he and his Republican predecessor, George Pataki, have tried 0% tax schemes in upstate New York. None of them have produced any economic growth. His whole understanding of economics is just way out of whack. What we need is massive government investment, and you can't do that unless you raise revenue.
Now the media has made a lot of noise about, this is going to be a more, progressive state legislator. A number of DSA-backed candidates, particularly if in New York City, were elected, and the Senate, now has a veto-proof two-thirds majority. But the actual numbers of new legislators, particularly on the left side of the aisle, is actually relatively small. So do you think we're going to see a more feisty, more progressive state legislature in the next 2 years?
I think it's a little difficult to say. I think one of the real problems that we've got is since 1980, a lot of folks have been imbued with the ideology of neoliberalism. It started with Ronald Reagan, Bill Clinton embraced it, and it's gone on from then. And the governor follows it. And I think until we start to understand that that is not good for the economy. It's not good for the middle class, that it's difficult to get progressive change in the legislature. But what I try to do on the stock transfer tax is address that problem and try to show people that this idea that unleashing global finance is going to bring us wealth is wrong. It's exactly the opposite. In fact, the billionaires and finance controlling our economy actually has led to the type of coup attempt that we saw in the Trump administration, because you have a lot of angry people out there. So it's very bad policy what we've been doing, and we have to change people's minds on that. I don't know if it's a, you know, left or right thing. I would say that we've got to get some of our legislators to try to realize that there are different approaches to economics that they're just not taking.
You've mentioned COVID, several times, and clearly that's, you know, perhaps the biggest problem, you know, facing the state at this point. With the legislature coming back into session, is there a sense that they may challenge some of this, grab of executive power the governor's given himself? And particularly, not only, you know, this summer was a lot of concerns raised about how we handled the nursing homes, but now even the counties are beginning to yell about, why are you doing this vaccine rollout using the hospitals rather than the system that we spent a couple decades putting together on how to handle mass vaccination? Is the legislature likely to try to weigh in on how the governor's handling COVID?
Unfortunately, I think this all relates to my answer to the last question. I voted against giving the governor extraordinary powers over COVID. Reason was that the health department already had adequate powers in the public health law to address these issues. The governor's a politician, and he has utilized this opportunity, which is his greatest strength from a public relations perspective. But, that's not really how government should work. I remember the member of the assembly who introduced the bill to give the money or the power to the governor actually said on the floor of the assembly that he would give that power to Andrew Cuomo, but not to Donald Trump. And I think that's really beside the point, that if you live in a democracy, you can't be giving extraordinary dictatorial powers to your executive, whether that person be Democrat or Republican. The idea of infectious disease is not new. This is just the latest outbreak of it. And we've had these problems in the past, and we dealt with them without giving this extraordinary powers to the governor. So I think, again, we need to get the members to think about this from the broader perspective of a democratic system of government, rather than we're going to do in the short run what we might think is politically attractive.
So we have a little bit less than 2 minutes left. What are some of the other, you know, key issues that you think the legislature will, you know, deal with in the coming session?
Well, I think we're going to have to deal with the legalization of marijuana, which I support. Now, I don't support it because it's a revenue raiser. It's not really. I support it because it's something we need to get out of the criminal justice system. As chair of the committee on alcoholism and drug abuse, which I was just appointed to, we need to make sure that this bill includes help for people who do have dependency on marijuana, because there are people who, you know, just choose for whatever reason, they end up smoking marijuana excessively, and it deprives them of the opportunities to do other things in their lives. So to say that marijuana is a harmless thing, I think, is wrong. But to say it should be handled through the criminal justice system when alcohol is not, I think the two are roughly comparable. So I would say this is like the repeal of prohibition when Franklin Roosevelt was president. It's something we have to do.
Okay. Well, we hope to be talking to you a couple more times, you know, during the legislative session. And good luck on trying to get the stock transfer tax to stop being rebated.
It's a long-term strategy.
This has been Assemblymember Phil Steck, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
Again, that was HMM's Mark Dunley with Assemblymember Phil Steck reacting to Governor Cuomo's State of the State address. Let us know what you thought about Cuomo's address on Facebook at WOOC 105.3 FM. Up next, the mob scene, called an insurrection, that took place in our nation's capital last Wednesday was addressed by Governor Cuomo in his State of the State speech. District Superintendent Quita Adams also addressed the insurrection in her Albany School Board address, in addition to the current COVID conditions. Paul Smart has the story.
The mob scene that many have called an insurrection that took place down in Washington last Wednesday, January 6, replicated in a smaller version at the state capitol that same day, has had a number of repercussions that have played out this week, including mention as part of the rollout presentation given by Governor Andrew Cuomo as his first State of the State speech in the state capitol on Monday, January 11th.
We saw the racism in the KKK parading on the streets in Charlottesville. We lived through the anti-Semitism in the shootings at the Tree of Life Synagogue and across the country. The distrust exploding after the George Floyd killing. And last week, we all watched in horror an attempted coup at the Capitol. These demons may not be new, but they are worse. Visionaries that have had the ability to see beneath the surface of America have long warned of the ugly reality below. Governor Mario Cuomo spoke of the danger of two Americas 40 years ago. But the low tide has exposed the ugliness for all to see. Today, there is no denying the injustice. And rhetoric is not the solution. The public is tired of unfilled political promises. Results are the solution. Doing justice is the solution. True justice, racial justice, social justice, economic justice. And that must be New York's banner to carry in America's post-COVID reconstruction.
At last Thursday's Albany School Board meeting, District Superintendent Quita Adams also addressed the insurrection, the recent Democratic Party wins in Georgia, and changing times as she talked about how Albany schools have been weathering this latest rise in COVID infections and deaths, as well as impending changes to how our kids school.
I would like to thank the many teachers and staff who have responded with the well-thought-out activities to facilitate student voice through an equity and social justice lens while examining the series of events regarding the presidential election, the election results in Georgia, and the process of confirming the votes of the Electoral College. Our instructional and support staff have been able to make real-world connections to the content areas through the content areas and in the social and emotional aspects of these teachable moments. Many of us watched the events that unfolded in our nation's capital on Wednesday with shock, with anger, sadness, and even disappointment. And while there were those who felt that these actions of storming the U.S. Capitol were justified, we have to look at the impact of these events and what they've had and will have on our nation and our democracy. As educators, we have a responsibility to seek out the teachable moments and ensure that these moments are contextualized in ways that connect to the experiences of our students and our families. As New York Senator Charles Schumer stated last night, after order was restored at the Capitol, It was a day that will live on in infamy. With these unconscionable acts etched in our memories, we move forward in hope that January 6, 2021 will also be remembered as a day that our painfully divided nation saw how we strive to educate our students about respect for each other, civic responsibilities, and the importance of equity and social justice in our everyday lives. We must ensure that moving forward, our actions represent the America, the democracy in which we believe and in which we want to live. We also move forward remembering that Wednesday was a day of historical significance. It was a day that Georgia, a state with a long and troubled history of intolerance and division, sent its first African-American representative and first Jewish representative to the United States Senate. A truly historic and symbolic moment for all Georgians as well as all Americans. As American citizens, we must aspire to be the positive change and the models of democracy that we want to see in this world. These are the lessons we must strive to teach in spite of deep and often complex ideologies that too often and too easily divide us. We are a nation that must and will continue to move beyond our troubled history toward a more inclusive and welcoming tomorrow. We must work together to make this the true legacy of real democracy. This must be the inheritance that we strive to leave for our children, a nation of all the people, by all the people, and for all the people. And for us here in Albany, we know that together we are stronger and we are better, because we are all in for Albany. This was the message that I shared this morning with our faculty and staff and with our community. And as we move forward through these upcoming months, as we look back through all that we have been through COVID-19, as well as through our election time and bringing about many of the social injustices that we have seen, it just begs the question, how do we make that positive difference in the lives of our children and be very genuine and sincere when we say what we believe, that we are here for our children first and foremost? We have to be honest in our communications. We have to be forthright in our actions, because our children model what they see us do. And it is extremely important that we keep that at the forefront of our decisions. This week, we started our week in a distance learning model. And as we near the end of this week, I want to express my thanks to our students, our families, faculty and staff for their flexibility and dedication that allowed our district to respond to the holiday surge in COVID-19. For our COVID-19 cases. The health and safety of everyone in our school community is top priority. So is the academic growth and the success of every student. We want all of our students to be back in school. And when I say all, not in a hybrid model, not in some type of one group coming, one group not coming. At the end of the day, we know that being in school, first and foremost, is best for our students. There is nothing that takes the place of in-person learning for our students. There's nothing that takes the place of a quality instructor and support staff member in our buildings working on behalf of our children. And so we have to balance these critical priorities during this pandemic. It has and will continue to be a challenge. However, we are up for that challenge. And I'm very appreciative of all the efforts of everyone who's made the effort and allowed us to persevere. We are prepared to resume our in-person learning model on Monday. We are also prepared if the need arises, that if we are in a zone, a micro cluster zone, we are prepared to do that testing. We are also looking to start voluntary testing beginning Monday as well, and we are putting plans in place should all of those things come into fruition. However, we must remain cognizant of our data, and should something happen over the next few days that warrants us extending our distance learning model, then we would need to make sure that we are prepared to do that as well. And so at this time, we will need to analyze our data and make sure that our data supports our decisions, knowing that we may have to have several safeguards in place in order to meet those needs. So I ask that our community please stay tuned for upcoming information with regard to what will happen next week.
This has been Paul Smart reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
And you just heard part of Governor Cuomo's State of the State speech, followed by District Superintendent Kawita Adams addressing the insurrection in her Albany School Board address, as well as the current COVID-19 conditions. For those just tuning in, I'm Alexis Goldsmith. You are listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOC 105.3 FM Troy and WOOS 98.9 FM Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. To learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, to listen online, and to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, check us out at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org and find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Media Sanctuary. Up next, Jamaica Miles spoke to Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer Elizabeth Press about the significance of white nationalists storming the Capitol in D.C., the underreported story of police brutality that happened at the New York State Capitol on January 6th, and the community response action taking place on Wednesday, January 13th in Albany, and more.
Today, I'm joined by Jamaica Miles, one of the co-founders of All of Us. She's here to talk about the insurrection at the state capitol. Jamaica Miles, welcome back to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you for having me back.
I just wanted to start off and hear from you as an activist, as a leader here in the capital region. What is your reaction to last week's insurrection at the state capitol by the Proud Boys and white nationalists and, well, other folks from around the country who flew in for that?
We're talking about white supremacists from across the country went to Washington, D.C. and took over the Capitol. For the first time in history, the Confederate flag was essentially flying at our state capitol, a flag that for many of us, we know the true meaning. It's about racism. It's about slavery. It's about oppression. And that happened. And we know why and how it happened. The sitting president incited a riot, had a call to arms to his supporters, and the state capitol was open for that to happen. There was not the armed guards and the National Guard and all of the military that we have seen whenever Black Lives Matter activists are about to show up. So they let them in the front door. Let's just hope that whoever is left that needed a wake-up call, that this is finally it.
You said that you would never see this at a Black Lives Matter protest. We've seen here in Albany, we've seen pepper spray, we've seen tear gas. A lot of people are talking about how many people were connected to letting this happen. And I just wanted to hear a little bit more from your point of view, the difference between how Black and Brown activists are treated when organizing on the street versus what we saw in Washington, D.C.
The pictures really do tell 1,000 words, 1,000,000 words, 1,000,000,000,000 words, right? To put side by side the images of white supremacists storming the Capitol and with no pushback. And not only getting inside, but then taking selfies, and they're in the legislative chamber and they're stealing government property. They were looting and rioting, right? The words that are often used for Black Lives Matter activists, regardless of what we're doing. And that was the scene versus if a Black Lives Matter activist is standing still, they can get pepper sprayed in the face and have. In Washington, D.C., we've had several of the leaders from All of Us went down to D.C. for the Black Lives Matter protests and in real time told us this is what's happening on the ground right now. We're chanting and we're having camaraderie and the police are coming at us. They didn't have to advance forward to be engaged by police. It seems as if it didn't matter what white supremacists did. They still were going to be given far more leeway than anyone else in Washington, D.C. And we saw it at capitals across the nation on the very same day.
And speaking of which, one in the Times Union, our local newspaper here, I read how quickly the bus to Washington, D.C. filled up. On the one hand, people in our community participated in this mob activity in D.C. And then also, I was wondering if you could talk about what happened here in Albany and the counter protests that happened. I tried to read a little bit of information about it, but really, I got as far as there was a stabbing. I wonder if you could say more.
Yeah, we have to say more because mainstream media said less. Because they not only didn't tell the story in its entirety, they actually rewrote the story and simply said, Proud Boy stabbed, right? That was it. As opposed to the fact that the Proud Boys, a right-wing extremist group, as identified by the FBI, right? So this isn't my opinion. This is the opinion of the FBI. So take it up with the FBI that they are a right-wing extremist group. I do agree with that assessment. They came to the Capitol, but the short version is, whether it's a Proud Boy, a 3%, or a Trump supporter, they're white supremacists. And they showed up, Black Lives Matter activists showed up to counter that protest and to say, no, we don't support what the president is telling you to do. Yes, Black Lives Matter, no justice, no peace. And what happened was that one of the white supremacists attacked a Black Lives Matter activist. Then Black Lives Matter activists were arrested. That is, and during the arrest, several of those Black Lives Matter activists, specifically the Black Lives Matter activists, were harmed by New York State troopers. We have on video them using knee holds on the head and necks of those individuals. We have the photos of the abrasions on the faces of individuals, specifically Lexis Figueroa, known as Els, a leader from Saratoga. He walked out of there not looking the way he did when he walked in when he was arrested. And the media simply said, you know, multiple activists were arrested. There was a stabbing. They also didn't delineate that there were different arrests for different things. Not all of the arrests were connected to the alleged stabbing. So they simply kind of put it out there and made it seem as if Black Lives Matter activists showed up and stabbed the white supremacist and made no mention or did any journalism around investigating what occurred on that day from start to finish. They took a quote and said, okay, this is the story, and they ran with it. And so we're going to tell the story, and we're going to do that tomorrow.
And speaking of which, on Wednesday, January 13th, all of us and other groups are holding a community response to white supremacy and police brutality. Can you tell us about this event?
Absolutely. At 12 noon, we'll be at East Capitol Park where this egregious act happened, where we saw, again, police brutality. And this time, at the behest of the New York State troopers, right? Because they are police. We don't often hear about them in the news, but hey, they exist as well as part of the police state. And they were the ones that harmed our friends and comrades. And the community must respond every time this happens. It cannot go unnoticed. It cannot go unspoken. We must stand up. And not just for the voices that we know. There are so many others that are harmed every single day that they don't have an organization standing behind them because they don't know an organization would, that they don't feel brave enough to actually speak out about what the abuse was that they've taken on at the hands of police because of fear of retaliation against them. And so we speak out not just for those that we know, but for those that we don't. And we have to continue to shine a light on it and demand that it ends. Governor Cuomo said that he wants reform. We demand transformation.
And what do you say to folks, like, based off of what you just said, where we know that there are ex-military, police, et cetera, on the side of these folks that mob the Capitol, that are planning to occupy all 50 state capitals? What do you say to people who are maybe scared to show up on Wednesday the 13th for this action?
I would say to you that on Wednesday, we're going to do what we always do, right? All of us as an organization has always held space. We will have our safety team there. There will be medics. There will be legal observers, because we don't show up unprepared. And we are going to allow there to be space for people's voices to be heard, that we will not be silenced. That is necessary to happen. And we are going to be safe distanced, because COVID is still real. We will have extra masks. We will have hand sanitizer, because we are going to be responsible in our actions and allow for voices to be heard. And we're going to hold that space for people. And we're going to demand that Black Lives Matter. My greater concern is that on the 17th, there's going to be this armed presence at capitals across the nation. There has been a call to arms by Trump and their supporters to be at every state capital. I actually caution and ask that all of us that stand for liberation and for justice, that we don't go to the capitals on those days, that we actually stay away. Let them show who they are. And we need not put ourselves in harm's way. Let the state troopers protect the Capitol. It is their job. So let them do their job that so many of them are proud of and fond of. And let us see the media tell that story again and see what it looks like this time.
Jamaica Miles, thank you so much for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
Jamaica Miles is the co-founder of All of Us. She was just speaking with HMM's Elizabeth Press about the significance of white nationalists storming the Capitol in D.C. and the community response action taking place on Wednesday, January 13th, 2021 in Albany. You can find All of Us on Facebook. Now we go to HMM's Catherine Rafferty with another episode of Birth Justice. Today she is joined by Rose Mitchell Tanerowitz, midwifery student and birth justice advocate from Albany. Today, Rose tells the story of her birth work journey and talks about her personal ethos on birth.
Maybe you could start with telling me how you got started with the birth work that you're doing.
I came to birth work after my own birth experience. My first son is 11. He was born in a hospital in Albany with a combination of midwife and obstetrician care. At the time that I got pregnant, I didn't have insurance. I was not married. And so I was able to get care through Medicaid, through what used to be the Moms Program, which provided Medicaid for anyone who was pregnant. And that for I think up to 3 months following the delivery of the baby, and then the baby was automatically enrolled in Medicaid for the first year of their life when they were born. So that was like a pretty revolutionary program for this country. And unfortunately, there's still a number of states that don't have similar programs. So there's still many, many people around the country who do not have options for insurance coverage. My birth experience was sort of like equal parts traumatizing and empowering. I knew what I wanted, but I didn't have the resources to really achieve it. And so as soon as my son was born, I had this strong sensation, like, I really want to do that again. Like, I want a do-over. And I ended up deciding to become a doula after that. I did my first doula training when my son was like 9 months old. And I did that here in Albany with an organization called DONA, which is like one of the larger doula certifying, might be the largest doula certifying organization. Then a few years later, I also decided to start doing postpartum work. I met another doula who was a postpartum doula, and we started a little business offering both birth and postpartum services. And then when I think it was about 2013 when I started to work for the Family Life Center in Albany, which was actually just around the corner from my house. And it's the oldest standing independent childbirth education and support center. So it's not actually a birth center. We still don't have any like real freestanding birth centers in this region. Working on changing that. Several people are working on changing that at multiple levels. Then my second son was born in 2014 at home with the midwife who I worked with at the center, as well as her midwife partner and my two doula partners who were my two very good friends. And that birth experience was such a tremendous contrast to the first. It felt extremely redemptive. It felt very healing. And it was also just like this totally normal event in our family's life. And, you know, I gave birth in my bedroom. I went to sleep in my own bed. I, you know, woke up in the morning and snuggled with both my children and got to eat, you know, wholesome food of my choosing. And, you know, it was easy for family to come and visit. And it was just lovely. So I continued to work as a doula up until 2018, by which point I had decided to become a midwife. And was enrolled in school, and it was just too much to also continue being on call because you know, children are demanding, school is demanding, and being on call as a birth worker, as a doula, is really demanding. And I just sort of knew I couldn't do all of those things at once. So I haven't been to a birth since August 2018, but I am almost halfway through my formal midwifery program. So hopefully I will be graduating in May of 2022 and licensed that summer and begin the next phase of my career.
Now, Victoria mentioned that you do some queer birth work. Did you want to talk about your experience with that?
I don't have a lot of experience working with queer families, but I myself am queer, and I identify as a lesbian, and I have worked in my capacity as an advocate and as an organizer to try to create queer-friendly spaces within the birth world. The fact is that, you know, every human being on the planet is born from someone, and the way that we do birth in this country is incredibly violent and incredibly corrupt. It's corrupted by our society's like overarching philosophy, which I think I would most aptly describe with the words hetero, you know, patriarchal, white supremacist-driven capitalism. If you look at the history of birthing, it's birthing in hospitals is a phenomenon that's only about 100 years old or less, depending on where you are and depending on who you are. So this notion that that birth belongs in a hospital under the care of a surgeon is just, to me, is very clearly informed by a profit-driven, you know, way of thinking. And if you look back at the history of birthing in America in particular, you can see some serious inequality. I think the history of midwifery is a great place to look, especially in regards to Black birthing people and to Black midwives, because, you know, when I say hospital birth for some people, I'm really referring to the way the history that we have of segregation and of apartheid in our country. And for, you know, decades, Black women were not able to access hospital birth and obstetrician services unless there was a true emergency, because the hospitals were segregated. And so, like, you know, the public health agencies in southern states in particular realized that they needed to do something to provide support to the communities. And so they started to sort of codify midwifery, which was a skill and a practice that was preserved by the Black midwives of the, you know, the granny midwives of the South. Those women had to do the work that they did to serve their community because there were no other options. However, it was just part of their tradition. It was part of their culture. And at some point in the early 20th century, you know, white women decided that they were going to create a midwifery profession and really delegitimize the work of the granny midwives and the traditional midwives of the South.
That was part one of this episode of Birth Justice with Catherine Rafferty speaking to Rose Mitchell Tenorowitz, midwifery student and birth justice advocate from Albany. We'll be playing part two tomorrow, but to hear both segments, go to mediasanctuary.org. And we'll close out the show with WOOC roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry, who spoke to political activist, organizer, and educator Tom Ellis about the history of the Martin Luther King Jr. labor and community holiday celebration in the Capital Region. This is part one of a two-part interview.
This is Willie Terry, your roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Network. And today I'm here with Tom Ellis, an organizer, a longtime organizer in the Capital Region. And Tom lived in Albany, right, Tom?
Yes, that's correct. I've lived in Albany nearly my whole life.
Right. And Tom, you're also a part of the Solidarity Committee of the Capital Region. You've been involved in a lot of other things. So why don't you tell me something about that?
I've been a Solidarity Committee member pretty much continuously for like the last 25 years. During the first 10 years, I was sort of on the fringes of it or a part of it, but not as close as in more recent years. I've been a longtime environmental activist. I helped shut down the Answers Trash Incinerator in Albany in 1994. I helped get a good cleanup of the depleted uranium waste dump and colony on the National Lead property. I helped prevent Albany from siting a landfill in Queens, right near the Lafarge plant. I've worked to preserve rivers in Canada from being transformed into hydroelectric stations with giant nasty reservoirs behind them with power lines built to the United States. I've done a lot of environmental work. I'm a longtime member of the Palestinian Rights Committee in Albany, which is an educational group, and we've been around since 1982. I'm a charter member, and we've done a lot of advocacy work. We had a newsletter for years. We used to have annual dinners. We write letters to the newspapers, and we've tried to encourage the public in this region to support what we believe is the just cause of Palestinians for certainly civil and political in their human rights and maybe their national rights.
Right. And Tom also is one of the key organizers of Martin Luther King event that happened every year here in the Capital District. And that's one of the reasons we're talking to him, to you know, talk to some of the people that be involved in this event. Tom, tell me a little bit about yourself. You say you're a teacher. What's your profession?
Yes, I work as a teacher. I work as a social studies teacher.
Oh, okay.
Global history and economics, participation in government, and current events.
And you think that has some influence on your life, being a global study teacher?
Sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
I said, you think that had a lot of influence on your life being a global study teacher? Because, I mean, you learn about what's happening throughout the world, right?
Yes, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. Knowing about what's going on in the world helps me to be a better global studies teacher.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, you've been, how long you been organizing?
I've been organizing since about 1980.
Mm-hmm.
In 1980, I went to New York State Public Service Commission hearings. I started doing that for 6 years. Each time Niagara Mohawk applied for an electric rate increase, I went in there and I cross-examined the vice presidents, trying to convince the state government that neither Niagara Mohawk nor its customers could afford Niagara Mohawk's very expensive nuclear power program.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried organizing people statewide in an effort to shut that program down, but was, you know, obviously I was not successful. Those reactors are still running out near Oswego. It's hard to organize statewide on nuclear power issues because most people don't live near the nukes. They don't see them, though. They're 100 miles away. They don't even know they're there. But I did a lot more organizing locally on the environmental issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, like getting closer to the topic at hand, when the Martin Luther King holiday became a national holiday, I think, in 1985, beginning almost immediately, the state government held a Martin Luther King holiday celebration in the convention center of the Empire Plaza. And Governor Mario Cuomo used to go to that event each year. And I think he spoke at it. And the events were not great. They were a little bit political, but not real political. And in 1994, the Answers Trash Incinerator in Albany was spewing poisons all over the city. And it was landing on the snow, turning the snow a dark, like a black color. And I said to Aaron Mayer, who's an environmental organizer who you might know, I said, Mario Cuomo's going to come in this door, and I want you to be there when he walks in the door, and you can talk to him, and he'll talk to you for a while. And I said, Dad, I'll be there, and we're going to tell him we want that incinerator shut down right now because it's poisoning the people of Sheridan Hollow and Arbor Hill and much of the city of Albany. It was a filthy incinerator. It was owned by the state. So Aaron Mayer standing there with his wife and his kids, and I'm standing there. Cuomo comes walking through the door. He sees me. He doesn't want to talk to me. He talks to Aaron Mayer. It worked perfect. And
yeah.
Mayer talked to him for maybe a half an hour. And 2 weeks later, Cuomo got together with the new Mayor Jennings in Albany and other people, and they shut down that trash incinerator.
Mm-hmm.
It was a spectacular victory for us.
Right.
Because for the children in Arbor Hill and in Sheridan Hollow, some of them were finally able to breathe clean air for the first time in their life.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really filthy, dirty operation.
Mm-hmm.
And when Pataki became governor, the event deteriorated quite a bit, and it had no political content at all.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us kept going to the event, and then after one of the events, in 1998, Fred Pfeiffer, who was a member of the Solidarity Committee, he said, this was not a good event. It was so pathetic. We can do better ourselves. Maybe we ought to try something. So we looked around at each other and said, yeah. So later in 1998, we began organizing the first Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday labor celebration.
So you're saying that because of the political character of that stadium, non-political character of the state.
There was no political content to it. We all know that Martin Luther King was a very serious political leader.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't about cosmetic change. He wanted real change.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he's a hero to so many people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he risked everything. And in fact, he lost his life doing it. Martin Luther King used to begin some of his speeches by saying, we're gathered here today for serious business. He set the right tone at the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted real solutions to real problems.
Mm-hmm.
And he was working on a national level starting when he was 26 years old. I mean, he was really, really very impressive.
Mm-hmm.
He built these huge coalitions.
Right.
He was optimistic. He knew things were bad, but he knew that, like he said, that the arc of justice bends towards the better.
Mm-hmm.
Or the arc of history bends towards improvements in justice. He took advantage of his opportunities. He said there are clear distinctions between good and evil. I mean, I was super impressed with Martin Luther King even when I was a kid. And so we began our event. First one was in 1999. It was held at the Wilburn Temple, mm-hmm. which is right near the Empire Plaza. Mm-hmm. And the theme of the event was civil rights, the labor movement, and the fight for the rights of black farmers and landowners. Mm-hmm. The keynote speakers were Connie McQueen, Coalition of Black Trade Unionists in District 65, Gary Grant, who was the president of the Black Farmers and Agriculturalists, and executive director of the Concerned Citizens of Tillery, North Carolina, and then Land Loss Fund. And John Funicello, the chairman of the Solidarity Committee, also spoke. And we had what we thought was a wonderful event. We had a good turnout. The downstairs of the Wilburn Temple was full. It wasn't packed, but it was full. And I think people were genuinely pleased. We promoted it as a family event. There were lots of kids there. It was all races and ages, so there were middle-aged people and older people there. It was really a beautiful event, and afterwards we decided to try to keep doing it. Mm-hmm. And we continued it for 4 years at the Wilburn Temple, and we could have continued it longer, but it just got to be too crowded in there. During the fourth year, it was like, I thought maybe it was a little too crowded, that if there had been some sort of an emergency or something, we might not have been able to get everybody out. We were clearly in violation of the fire code for the size of the attendance that we had. So we needed to move it to a bigger place, and we moved it to the Toast School, the Thomas O'Brien Academy of Science and Technology, mm-hmm. Which is in Lincoln Park. We held it there for, I don't know how many years, 6 or 7 years, and those were good events, and we got the Albany Public School Teachers to start working with us, and eventually we got New York State United Teachers to begin working with us. I'll just give you some of the speakers we had. In 2000 at our event, Alice Green of the Center for Law and Justice was a keynote speaker. Eddie Ellis, a relation of mine, a former New York State death row prisoner, spoke. 2001, Bill Fletcher Jr. In 2002, Aspacio Alcantara, Independent Farm Workers Center, William Bill Lucy, AFSCME Secretary Treasurer, National President of CBTU. We had, in 2004, our theme was Your Vote is Your Hope. 2007, A Labor of Love. 2008, really something that's really pertinent today, Voting Rights for All, Count Every Vote.
You just heard the first part of a conversation between HMM's roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry speaking with organizer and educator Tom Ellis. We'll hear part two tomorrow, in which they talk about the upcoming 2021 Martin Luther King Jr. event that will take place on January 18th online, and that event is hosted by the Sanctuary for Independent Media. There will be speakers, breakout groups, and live entertainment. To register for the free event, go to mediasanctuary.org. And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Alexis. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news, and you can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments or suggestions, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. And as a reminder, this program is produced by local volunteers. If you're interested in producing for this news program, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org. There is no experience required, and you will get a lot of support as you get started. Again, shoot us an email at info@mediasanctuary.org for details. And until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.